Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And you know, Ken, if I sound happy today, it's because the sun is out, it's a warm day in Washington, and you're back. You're not traveling. It's good to have you here in the studio.
Thanks. What are you up to?
Well, I'd just like to say we're going to spend the next 15 minutes talking about the budget, your
favorite
subject.
Okay, take care. I'm traveling. Bye. See you, Ron.
No, look.
Okay.
This is the most important business facing America today.
Well, it is, actually, and you know it's very important because you can see all the profiles and courage going on in Washington.
Absolutely. One leader after another stepping up and saying, I know this is going to be bad for my political career, but I think it's time we face the tough decisions for the long term and cut entitlements and cut defense spending and raise revenue and cut all these other programs, too, that provide things like heat in the homes of old widows.
Well, but I think you're misunderstanding the governance of Washington, D.C. Ken Conrad doesn't care about his political future.
How about Ken Conrad?
Yeah,
that guy was willing to step right up on your program, on Talk of the Nation, this week and say, you know, Ken, it's time we just cut everything.
And he doesn't care. He's not worried about his political future.
Because
Oh,
that's right.
He's retiring.
He is not running for re-election.
Oh, no wonder. Oh, I see.
No. Well, I don't think that's the reason, though. I think he really just has come to this conviction.
Yeah.
I also heard another senator on our air this week, on Morning Edition, saying a lot of brave things. I think he said something about cutting $450 billion out of Medicare. I actually heard a United States senator say this.
Who was that?
Al Simpson.
Oh, wait a second. He's a former United States.
He retired, what, 20 years ago?
In 96. Yeah. Yeah.
And now he's in the Professional Debt Reduction Fiscal Commission.
With Erskine Zimbalist Jr.
That's right. He's now known as Simpson Bowles. And his job is to recommend ways to the president to reduce the federal budget deficit.
Right. And they had this commission, and they had these major recommendations.
Took $3 trillion out of the deficit in the course of 10 years.
So when President Obama, who unveiled his budget this week, he was criticized by the press and Republicans for just not being bold enough. Enough leadership, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and it was especially contrasted against the other people who came out and showed leadership and said, no, we're prepared to take the hit. We're going to make these tough decisions. And
Well, the House Republicans, first of all, originally it was going to be $30 billion cut in spending by fiscal year September 30th. Now it went to $61 billion.
Would that
eliminate
the federal deficit?
See, that's the thing.
For 1 year, even?
Unless we touch Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, we're not talking about making a big dent in the deficit at all.
Now, let me just say this for all the activists and people who are hugely concerned about Social Security. Social Security, you know, is part of the problem. It's part of the overall budget picture, but it's kind of separate. Too. You could cure Social Security for perpetuity, just as far as the eye can see, with a couple of small changes.
You could raise the retirement age.
You raise the retirement age, not for people who are currently nearing retirement, but for people who are very young today. And you could also raise the cap on how much salary is subjected to the Social Security tax. Right now, it's only about $106,000. After that, people go scot-free on Social Security tax. You could raise that $120,000, $150,000. If you raise it not very far, it wipes out the whole problem for Social Security. So that's not the tricky part of the problem. Social Security is the easy part. You could take care of it. The big part is Medicare costs, which are truly explosive, and people are living longer, people need a lot of medical care, everybody wants medical care, and we're all on the hook for it.
Right, and the costs are going up dramatically year in and year out, absolutely.
And as Al Simpson said the other day, if you don't go in and take hundreds of billions of dollars out of the long-term costs for Medicare, you aren't addressing the real problem. And all these budget cuts that President Obama's talking about and that the House Republicans are talking about and, you know, preening about and saying, look what we're willing to do, are all addressed to the discretionary budget, which is just 12% of the overall
budget. Yes, but the President Obama did say at his news conference, give me some time, things will happen.
This town, let's face it, you guys are pretty impatient. If something doesn't happen today, then the assumption is it's just not going to happen.
Now, there's another factor in this that's a little different this year, and that is that we are nearing the debt limit, the statutory point at which the government cannot borrow any more money. Now, we've hit this before periodically, and Congress passes a bill, and the president signs it saying, we're now going to borrow more than that, and we raise the limit. But it is an actual dollar figure in the $14 trillion range, and we are coming up on it. And at some point this spring, that limit is going to have to be raised, or else what?
Or else we go into default.
Yeah, well, we can't go into default. I mean, the United States cannot go into default on its debt obligations or the entire
world
economy.
But the government shuts down. The government shuts down.
That's the
other
option.
And that's what we saw in 95, where the Republicans paid for the Newt Gingrich decision to call Bill Clinton's bluff.
That's right. Bill Clinton vetoed their overall appropriations omnibus, and there was no other bill. They didn't give him another bill to sign, and the government started shutting down.
But you know who's really talking about? I mean, for the longest time, we were hearing Tea Party folks talk about, well, we'll shut the government down if we have to, rather than increase the debt limit. But I think Democrats are talking about it more, because ultimately, this is a political game of chicken here.
They're trying to make the Republicans look irresponsible.
Exactly. As comparing it to 95 and comparing it to the situation today, and also talking about the Republican Party of today, which is, I know, in most any objective view, is more radical than it was in 95.
So interestingly, at that time, the Republicans believed, and I remember watching this and covering it, they believed that if the government started to shut down, people would side with the Republicans and say,
Republicans yeah, said so.
That's
yes.
right. We think the government should shut down, at least in part, at least for a period of time, rather than spend more money. And we're coming up on, even before the debt limit decision, we're coming up on an expiring continuing resolution, which expires on March 4th. They can always push it further into March and probably will. But at least for the moment, we have a very near prospect for one of these train wrecks, as they call them, one of these standoffs where neither side wants to give. And we could see a government shutdown as soon as a couple of weeks from now. Yeah, what do you think the odds are of that?
I think it doesn't happen. I think for all the balancing games that John Boehner and Mitch McConnell have to play in trying to weigh the demands of the Tea Party folks and weigh the establishment and everybody else, I think they know that politically it would be a disaster for the Republican Party, and they can just make sure it doesn't happen. Maybe they'll get some concessions out of Obama about spending, things like that, spending priorities, which ultimately won't affect the deficit at all, but at least politically it'll be more saleable to the folks back home to say why they raised the debt limit.
Back in 95, one of the ways that the Republicans suffered in this shutdown war was that Newt Gingrich became part of the story.
He became the story.
He largely became the story, and he complained about the seat he was given on Air Force One flying over to Israel. And he was portrayed in much of the cartoon press as a baby crying
over
things.
The front page of the New York Daily News, the caricature of Newt Gingrich, crybaby, was the front page headline.
That's right. And it didn't help them in the budget shutdown wars. I would suggest that we're nowhere near that with John Boehner. He's been very careful not to make it about him, but he slipped up this week. He was caught saying, so be it, when he was told that there might be a million jobs lost by the budget cuts that the Republicans are making, because after all,
that's not what he said. I mean, he did say so be it, but it was in response to a question about the fact that the Obama administration may have created 200,000 new jobs, and the question was, well, what if some of those jobs are lost? And he said, so be it.
All right, but he is essentially saying that he understands that if you cut the federal budget deeply, fast, the way they're proposing to do, in discretionary spending, not the kind of things that go out to constituents like Medicare payments
right.
and Social Good Security payments,
right.
but functions of the government, you put people out of work. That's the only way you save money. You put people out of work. And by doing that, you're essentially putting at risk the recovery of jobs in particular, which
we
all know
is
the big deal.
Right, right.
And everyone says it's supposed to be jobs, jobs, jobs. So when he's reminded that jobs are going away, and you're right, he was referring to this 200,000 number, not the larger
estimates.
Which
may not even be the right number anyway.
And that may not be right either, but he was being told, your cuts cost jobs.
Right.
And he said, so be it. The next day, the crucial issue before Congress, or one of the many crucial issues in this discussion of the budget, was a jet fighter engine, which is not wanted by the Pentagon, which already has paid for another engine for this particular jet fighter. But it's a project that's very popular in a lot of parts of the country where they've been working on this engine and where people have jobs because
of this engine. Including right next to John Boehner's district in Ohio.
There you go. Suddenly, John Boehner is in favor of a special exception for that project, even though the Pentagon doesn't want it. He doesn't see that as pork barrel spending. He doesn't see that as a so be it place to cut jobs. He sees that as a threat to people back in his home district.
Right. And then, therefore, the role of National Party leader seemed to fall on Tom Rooney, a sophomore Republican, basically treating John Boehner as one of those selfish
part of the problem.
Part of the problem, and saying, wait a second, the Pentagon doesn't want it. Let's send a signal to our voters that, look, here's one way the Republicans are cutting back on the budget, and here's a perfect example. Let's cut this F-35 engine.
All right. So hats off to Tom Rooney. And I'm certainly not saying that John Boehner has made himself a Newt Gingrich kind of distraction.
Right, I agree.
But the leaders have a difficult problem. They have to take care of their constituencies, as always. They have to take care of their members who have constituencies, as always. And that creates the problem that they may look like hypocrites.
Yes, yes, I agree with that. There's also another way of looking at it, that John Boehner, I mean, who knows what's public and what's private with John Boehner, but he also said the fact that, look, was I surprised by this Rooney move? I was. You know, does it affect my relationship with Rooney? No, it does not. But it's another way. This is the way I run the House. It's democracy. It's an open process that is not a preordained thing. One thing about we've seen for Congress for many years, if not decades, under both Democrats and Republicans, is that much of the vote is a foregone conclusion. It looked like that this was a true open vote and a real debate
and a real vote, and that's kind of exciting.
John Boehner's "So be it" reminds me of the famous New York Daily News headline, "Ford to New York, drop dead." I mean, it's something.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, and it's something that could probably come back to bite Boehner and the Republicans when the Democrats want to use this as an issue against the callous Republicans.
That would be sort of unfair of the Democrats to do that, though,
no,
wouldn't
it,
Ken? I mean, wouldn't that be sort of, you know, a little bit out of bounds?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
And, you know, there's also gambling at CPAC. Because I bet that Ron Paul is going to be the Republican nominee for president because he won the presidential straw poll at CPAC 2 years in a row now.
Now, let's say, first of all, Conservative Political Action Conference. That's what CPAC is.
Correct.
It's a gathering in Washington. It's been going on for more than 30 years. And it attracts thousands of people who at least drop by for a while. And several thousand of them stuck around to the end on Saturday afternoon and voted in this straw poll, which for the second year, as you say, was won by Ron Paul, who will now, of course, be the nominee of the Republican Party in 2012.
Well, and the funny thing is, there's two topics here. I'll get to Ron Paul winning these straw polls in a moment. But CPAC, 4 years ago, Mitt Romney finished first. Rudy Giuliani finished second. This is 2007, the year before. That's comparable to where we are now. Sam Brownback finished third. This was the top three at CPAC in the year going into the year before the 2008 presidential election.
What about John McCain?
He finished fifth. First of all, he didn't even show up at CPAC, and he finished fifth. So you could talk about all you want about what this means or what it doesn't mean. I don't know what it means.
All right. But let's also say that the Republican Party of 2007 and the Republican Party of 2011 are two different animals.
That's a very important point, because we keep saying that when Ron Paul wins these straw polls, but it does not transfer into real votes in the primaries and caucuses. That was true in 2008. But as you say accurately, for a change, that 2012, it's a different Republican Party. And who knows what a Ron Paul type candidate is going to look like in 2012. Now, you know, he's out to Iowa next month. So, I mean, he's 75 years old. He'll be 76 this summer. But from all indications, he's running again.
Yes, I think he is running again. But here's why I don't take him seriously as a national candidate. He's not going to win in Iowa.
No.
Where his particular kind of libertarianism does not sell with the social conservatives who run the show there. He is not going to win in New Hampshire, although he'll possibly have a little better showing there where he speaks a little bit more to the zeitgeist of New Hampshire. And he is for certain not going to win in South Carolina, where despite the fact that he's a Texan, his whole worldview is so at odds with the South Carolina Republican Party, not least of which is Ron Paul's feeling that we should completely withdraw from all of our military commitments all around the world and have nothing to do with the kind of aggressive pursuit of foreign policy that the Republican Party has been all about
for
generations.
Doesn't Ron Paul realize what a success Iraq was? What's wrong with him?
Ron Paul has his points to make, but he's probably making them in the wrong place. If he were to run as an independent in a Ross Perot style,
or
as a libertarian, which he did in 1988. Right. He was actually the nominee of the Libertarian Party. If he were doing that, he could have his enthusiasts, and there were many here at CPAC, without having to also go up against that other part of the Republican Party that has a totally different worldview.
One of the weirdest things, one of the most surreal things at CPAC, I mean, and there's always surreal things going on at CPAC, but the most attention was given to a Donald Trump speech.
By the way, Ron Paul could not get elected, I'm sorry to tell you.
That particular speech by Donald Trump was played over and over and over again on Fox News the next day, while the other news outlets around the world were a bit more interested in Egypt. But Fox really thought that was an important point that Donald Trump made, and they really wanted to get that on, and they played it a lot. That, I think, drove a lot of the interest in Donald Trump, who is otherwise a complete non-player in this game. He's not going to run for president
in
the Republican.
Well, he's hinting he will.
Well, and he's not going to run for president.
10 years ago, he ran, almost ran as a Reform Party candidate, pro-choice, pro-gay rights, and things like that.
More power to him. Yeah. He should run for president. Everyone who wants to should run. Donald Trump is not going to run as a Republican.
But he is the heir apparent.
There is that. There is undeniably that. And by the way, while I'm mentioning, you know, that Fox paid more attention to Donald Trump than it seemed to be paying to Egypt there for a while, why was there no talk about Egypt at the CPAC other than Ron Paul saying we never should have been giving them $1 billion in military aid a year?
I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of people are focusing on the fact that the Republicans have been pretty silent. Maybe because it worked out, maybe ultimately it decided it's a success for the Obama administration. And if that's the case, how do you criticize Obama on Egypt? I mean, if there was caution. And
for the moment, at least.
For the moment,
since
sure.
we don't really know what's going to happen.
Sure, and there was criticism of Obama when he was basically not sure whether to side with Mubarak or with the protesters in for those couple of weeks. So, I mean, I just kind of think they kind of stayed away from it. One, because a lot of them are governors who don't have foreign policy experience.
And don't want to get their shoes, you know, dirty on this particular moment.
I mean, when you think of the headliners, you know, in the Republican Party, it's the Sarah Palins, it's the Mitt Romneys, it's the Mike Huckabees, it's the Tim Pawlentys.
All former governors.
The Haley Barbers.
They're not even
the
current
Mitch Daniels. Oh, yeah, some current.
All right, Barber Daniels. And Daniels are current ones. Yeah. And interestingly enough, all of those people you just named, except Sarah Palin, came to CPAC. Now, most of them didn't get out of single digits in the straw poll. Only Romney was out of single
right.
digits.
Haley Barber had 1%, 4%.
Yeah. Gary Johnson, on the other hand, former governor of New Mexico, we have to go back a decade to find, you know, Gary Johnson. He was there. He gave a speech. He said, let's legalize and tax marijuana. And he got 6%.
Yeah.
You put him together with Ron Paul, you were starting to crawl up on 40% of the total straw poll vote was for these people with highly libertarian ideas.
Well, Gary Johnson actually is talking about running for president on the Libertarian Party ticket.
Yes, and that's another reason not to take him too seriously as a Republican.
Well, and also I think next in line was Chris Christie, who I don't know what he is. I know he's Tea Party people like him. But he's kind of moderate on a lot of social issues, too. So I don't think he's the kind of guy that a CPAC group would love. And yet he got a pretty good percent. Look, let's see, we're making such a big deal of the CPAC thing. What I thought was most interesting is that one of the best speeches I thought was given by Mitch Daniels, except he has the problem. He's the governor of Indiana, a very serious guy.
And he's term limited, so he's looking for work.
Who's talking about, you know, the red ink in the government and how dangerous this is. But he also said that we should, like, eschew...
Like Anna Eschew.
We should eschew social issues, and that's not what the CPAC people want to talk about.
It is interesting because Mitch Daniels definitely seemed to be trying to establish his credentials as a truth teller. He was hitting some of the applause lines, hitting some of the things he knew would be popular, but he was also saying things such as,
purity and martyrdom is for suicide bombers.
Which is the opposite of Barry Goldwater's.
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
I really think Mitch Daniels is an interesting man for the hour in the conservative movement, in the Republican Party, but I'm not sure he's going to run for president. He's apparently got a lot of personal uncertainty about it, and let's face it, you can't run for president if you're not sure you want to do it.
Well, we keep hearing that about everybody. Mike Huckabee, who's put on a bunch of weight, is that a sign that he's not running?
And Haley Barber's taken off that weight.
And Haley Barber, every time the issue of race comes up, there's a thing that...
He says something else awful.
Well, but even if he doesn't say it, the press makes a big deal of it. The thing with the this license plate and the Mississippi that's going to honor
Nathan Bedford Forrest,
right,
one of the most outrageous racist figures in American history.
Well, everybody was in the Confederacy. I mean,
he ordered a massacre of black federal troops at the end of the Civil War.
Right. No, and look, Haley Barber says, I am not going to denounce the people who are pushing for license plates for this. First of all, it's a Democratic legislature. They're not going to pass it. It's not going to happen. But I'm not going to bother with it. But every time that happens, then the headline says, Barber defends Klansmen, blah, blah, blah. And again,
yeah. It doesn't work. And I mean, I don't know how you play being the governor of Mississippi in 2012. Without it bringing some of this heat, and he does not seem to be very good at deflecting it.
We're talking about 2012. I think maybe we could talk a little bit about Senate races because some Senate news came out of Arizona this week.
That's right. John Kyle, who is actually the number two leader among Republicans in the Senate, has decided he's had enough. And to a lot of people's surprise, he's not going to stick around to try to become the Senate majority leader. And I do mean majority because these Republicans are on the march in 2012 and have every prospect of being the majority party. in the 113th Congress.
Republicans are on the cusp of taking the majority after 2012 elections. You think he'd hang around to be the majority whip?
Yes.
Under Mitch McConnell, he says, I've had enough.
Or the leader, because we have no idea how much longer Mitch McConnell will be the leader of the Republicans in the Senate. Not that I know of any special problem that he has, but we know he's atop a very slippery mountain.
But if John Carroll's decision to retire was a surprise, I think it's not a surprise seeing some of the Republicans who are out there within minutes. It seemed like Jeff Flake, who's been around since 2001 in
Congress, the House.
Very conservative, very strong fiscal hawk, announced his candidacy.
And a remarkably personable guy. And unlike a lot of the fiscal hawks who like to come on, you know, kind of tough. On the other hand, there are a couple of hot and heavy Republican conservatives in Arizona who aren't going to let him waltz to that nomination.
Well, there are other Republicans being mentioned. Trent Franks, a member of Congress, has been mentioned. But J.D. Hayworth, who's a firebrand who ran against McCain in last year's primary.
How did he do?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah.
Glad to meet you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what about Joe Arpaio?
Well, that's the one I like.
Yeah,
see,
I know you do.
This is the sheriff from the Maricopa County,
that's
from
right.
Phoenix area, who has made a reputation for being 100% tough on illegal immigration.
That's right. But you're not now tough, Joe Arpaio.
You are not. And so if that is the issue, as it certainly has been in recent cycles in Arizona, maybe Joe Arpaio's moment has arrived to move on to the United States Senate. He was asked about it this week, and he says, I think I could do that job.
Yes, and there's a new poll polls are so ridiculous at this point, but there's a new poll that showed him leading the Republican field that includes Jeff Flake. And remember, the last time a Democrat was elected to the Senate in Arizona was Dennis DeConcini.
Oh.
And the reason he won is because the Republicans beat themselves up in a primary in 1976.
That's right. Bill Steiger? No.
Yes, it was Bill Steiger and John Conlon. Wait, no.
It wasn't Bill Steiger. It was
Sam Steiger.
Yeah. That's right.
Before we leave Arizona, there's one thing that's bugging me. A lot of Democrats and a lot of journalists are talking about, well, maybe Gabby Gifford should run for this seat.
Yeah. Now,
explain this to me.
Well, all right, because it's a great story. That's why.
Yes.
Look, you've got a choice. You could say
it's
could be Raul Grijalva, or it could be Janet Napolitano.
Ed Pastor.
None of those people is going to have a shot of winning in Arizona in 2012.
Napolitano
was very popular when she was governor. That was a while ago. The world has changed. Now she is an emissary of the Obama administration. I don't think she has a shot. But Gabby Giffords is a legend. She is larger than life.
Now she is, right.
Yes. And in the same way that Tim Johnson, who was already a senator when he had the stroke and was forced to use a wheelchair and so on, was able to be easily reelected, whereas before the stroke he was not able to be easily reelected. He had the narrowest win his year that he was reelected. This could be one of those things that's just out of everybody's control, even if it's clear she is impaired.
If
it's clear that she will never be quite the same,
I say
that is an compelling story, and in our politics, I would not rule it out in this era, in this time.
I say we wait till 2016 when John McCain retires and then she runs. Let her recover, as we hope she does, in 2012.
On the human scale, on the human front, I would say absolutely right. But you know how this works.
I know.
This could be the seat that decides who controls the Senate, and the Democrats are not going to pass on the opportunity without at least considering giving it to Gabby Giffords.
Well, one big name in Virginia who earlier had ruled out a run, even if Jim Webb were to retire.
And Tim Kaine, former governor.
And the current DNC chair. He is now going to meet with President Obama this week to talk about a prospective run for the Senate seat that the Republicans are likely to put up George Allen.
George Allen, and although he will not be without a challenge.
Jamie Ratke from the Tea Party, right?
Right. But let's say it's going to be George Allen. Let's say that you are either the President of the United States or the Chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Would you let everybody know that you were going to have a meeting together to discuss whether or not you were going to run for this seat?
And not run? Oh, yeah, there's no question.
All right. So Tim Kaine is in.
Yeah.
And it looks like Kaine versus Allen, and that's kind of an interesting rematch of the latter part of the last decade versus the first part of this decade. It'll be a very interesting matchup. Hey, one thing we can't get away without talking about before we have our next podcast, Chicago might have a new mayor.
On Tuesday, February 22nd, is the race to succeed the retiring Richard M. Daley and Rahm Emanuel, the former White House Chief of Staff, former congressman. It looks like...
Driver's seat.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the whole story was basically whether he'd be on the ballot or not. Now that story has gone away, it looks like the last poll I saw had 49% of the vote. He needs 50% plus one to avoid an April 5th runoff. It looks like he will do it.
If that poll is right, he will have 50% plus one.
You know, for all the talk about who Rahm Rahm Emanuel is and what a creep he is and what, you know, the mouth he has been very, to me, very, very impressive on this. You know, he's been good-natured. He's having fun with it. He's been very accepting of everybody and saying, look, you know, let's
he's
wait.
He's been remarkably open-armed towards all Chicagoans.
Very impressive.
He is
campaign.
Leading all the black candidates
right. Well,
in the African-American community in the polls.
Right. There's only one major one, Carol Moseley Braun, who has her own problems. As
who has her
she
own
would.
Problems. But the point is, he has really run for all Chicagoans. He has run a brilliant campaign. He had it largely wired before he even got in. And once he got past the residency question, it was all over but the shouting. He needs 50% to be elected next week. I think he gets it.
I agree.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Getting to know you. Putting it my way, but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new things I'm learning about you day by day. Getting to know you, getting to know all.